Thank you, Steve. My name is Viv Engel. Please call it Viv, because if anybody calls me Vivian, I kind of get irritated about that. Had a rough time with that name growing up. I never did find out why my parents named me that. I don't know whether they were expecting a girl or not. And incidentally, I've had a few people to be rather surprised here when I met them that they didn't meet a woman with that name that I had on the name tag. But anyway, it's a pleasure to be here with you. This marvelous, marvelous convention. And I've enjoyed every minute of it up to now. And the people that we've met here, and the wonderful welcome that we've had here, the warmth, and the real friendships that we have developed here and renewed from those that we have known. So on the part of May and myself, who is here with me, I want to express deep gratitude for the privilege of participating in this wonderful 19th convention of the AA in Georgia. I don't have too much of a story to tell you about myself. I did the usual things in my drinking days. I didn't drink until I was 23 years old, incidentally, but don't let anybody tell you that it takes 10 years to create one whenever they start, because mine happened rather rapidly. I was reared in a parsonage. Alcohol was taboo there, of course. And it was in the mountains of western North Carolina, from which I come, that my father, a minister there, fought valiantly against the open bar rooms in that particular area. And so, as I say, it was taboo in the home in which I was reared. And then I went away to school. We moved around a good bit in his ministry, and I was put in a prep school near Asheville, and I stayed there until I went to the university. And there, I became the smart aleck that a lot of us do. I was required to go to church from the time I was a babe in arms, every time the church door opened. And so I suppose it was a rebellion that set in at the university that I decided that my career should be that of an agnostic, if not an atheist. And so I didn't darken the church door during my career. We have an urgent message here from Mrs. Emma Perrier, is that it? Mrs. Emma Perrier is wanted at the desk, please. And so during my college career, I frowned on anything that smacked of religion or smacked of Christianity, or indeed that smacked of spirituality. But you know, we have a way of creating a void for ourselves as we go along in life. And so I weathered the university there, and I came out and went into newspaper work as a reporter. And there indeed I found that drinking was part of the profession of the newspaper man. And by the way, I found out whenever I began to get on the circuit a little bit and having the privilege to speak to certain groups, I found out that practically every other profession considered it an occupational hazard of error profession too. I spoke to a group of ministers one time, and I found out that they had it too. So I felt like, well, perhaps this is just kind of a general illness that we have. And so, as my career in drinking progressed and my repertorial career regressed under that impetus, I became addicted to alcohol, and rather rapidly. I still considered it the thing to do, to drink, to, as we wrote about things and about people who drank, but I didn't consider myself as one afflicted with any illness whatsoever. I was in the controlled area, of course. Some people call it the social, I don't know what that is. It was controlled to a degree. And so as time went along, and I began the usual route of hospital rest homes, they called them then. Never have figured that out. Never have been able to figure that out, because certainly there was very little rest around those places in my day. But anyway, I went the usual route there, the hospitals and things like that. On my particular territory, on my assignment at one time, I was assigned to the state hospital to write a series of stories. And I went out there and I stayed a while, voluntarily, and produced this series of stories. And they were printed. And within about 2 years, I went out there again, involuntarily this time, involuntarily. I would like to sort of defend myself in this particular position. I don't expect you to believe this, but I wasn't drinking at the time. I had been drinking at the time, and I went away from our little town. I didn't want to bring any degradation on the family. I'd been drunk there several times before. I don't know why it dawned on me at this particular time. So I went to the home of a relative, a very devout Christian relative. And there it was my sister. There she made up her mind that this kid brother of hers was not going to be seen on the streets of her town, hungover, or in any condition that might even indicate the use of alcohol at all. And I was policed very carefully. But one night, she turned her back. I got out, and I went to a doctor. And I told him, I said, now I'm coming apart at the seams here. I really don't want to drink, and I'm afraid I'm going to. Incidentally, I was a binge drinker, and I was coming off of this thing, I thought. But this close surveillance, this constant reminder of the fact that the family name was becoming besmirched because of me, and that sort of thing, all with the best of intentions, I'm quite sure. And I was unable to sleep very well. And I went to see this doctor, and he recognized my condition. And he said, well, Bib, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm not going to give you a prescription. Your sister wouldn't like for you to take that to the drugstore. I'm going to give you a physician's sample of a sedative, and I'm not going to tell you what it is either, because from what it did to me, I don't want you to go through with it. Anyway, he says, take one of them and go to bed, and if you haven't gone to sleep in a couple hours, take another one. Well, 2 days later, I came to in a straitjacket on a cement floor in a what might be called a laughing academy or a nut business or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, it was a rather rude awakening there. I was committed. It wasn't anything voluntary about this. I was committed there. And so after a day or so, I was taken to the office of a doctor there for an interview. And he looked at me. And he was one of the ones that I got most of my information from in writing this series of articles on the state hospital. And he looked at me and he said, my God, Viv, you're not crazy? And I said, well, somebody is, and I'm here, so you'll have to draw your own conclusions about that. But they were very kind there. I was there for observation. I never caught them at it, but that's what they said I was there for. And for 26 days, I remained there, and I tried to behave myself. And that was back in the days, you know, when the shock treatment was coming into vogue, and they decided one day that perhaps the shock treatment, they explained it this way. They said, Viv, you're not truly an alcoholic. That's just a symptom. Boy, that symptom gave me hell for a long time. But you're it's just a symptom of a deep-lying depression. A deep-lying depression. And we feel that perhaps that you should have the shock treatment. And now that scared me, because as a reporter, I had seen 17 men at the state penitentiary take the shock treatment, and they didn't get well. And it really frightened me. I didn't know too much about this thing. And so I thought, well, I didn't know what to do. They said, they explained to me, it's harmless, it won't do you any damage at all. And says, well, we will write to your sister to get permission. I said, wait a minute. You told me this thing was harmless, that there's nothing to it. And what you want to write to her about? Well, it's just routine. We've got to get permission. I said, just in case something happens, is that what you're talking about? Well, they didn't explain, but I couldn't stop them. They were going to do it anyway. So I thought about it. And we alcoholics have a reputation sometimes of being stupid and sometimes of being manipulators. In this particular institution, I found a guy who was going out that day. And I sent a telegram, got him to take it out for me, to this beloved sister of mine. She had no children of her own. She wasn't very proud of the fact, but she was much older than I and had a great hand in rearing me. And so I thought, well, I'll end this thing once and for all. And I just said something like this. God forgive me for this, but I said something like this. They have agreed that I shall take the shock treatment. If anything happens, my blood is on your hand. Now, I thought that would do it. I knew my sister loved me, and I didn't think she knew much more about the shock treatment than I did, and I thought the fright and the genuine affection would work its way, and I felt pretty good about the thing. And I went around, as I was sure that that they wouldn't apply it to me. 3 days later, they had a way of calling what they called a shock roll. 3 days later, they called a shock roll, and I was sitting there feeling sorry for these guys. And right at the end of it, they said, Engel. I practically collapsed. I thought I had it arranged. And I staggered up the steps. It's about the only thing I could do. And it's a surprising thing how sometimes we get the brakes on these sort of things. That when I got up the steps, they had researched me a little. At one time, I had the ambition and an enthusiastic ambition of becoming a physician. At the university, my course was a pre-medical course, and I didn't get any further in medicine than that. And that's, you're not licensed to practice on that diploma. But when I got up the stairs, why, I found out this, that they wanted me, why me with this background, to help with the shock treatments. And my help was holding them on the table while they shocked them. But I learned a lot there. I saw people who it really has helped. It helped them a great deal. Strange as it may seem, I saw a man brought in there one night. He was emaciated, practically a skeleton. And he must have been crazy because they said he was trying to commit suicide by starvation. I never had heard of that, but he looked just the same. And during my time there, we didn't have a great variety of delectable foods, but I saw him eat 27 sweet potatoes for supper one night. It helps your appetite. And so it doesn't help alcoholism, but you'll eat. But this doctor that I... That's the only time I saw this doctor, was at this initial interview when he told me I wasn't crazy. The one at in the shock department, he's the one that pulled this depression business on me, and I didn't realize what a instrument, what a tool he was giving me. Because as I told you, I was reared in a parsonage, and I was never able to take a drink without feeling guilty about it. I never liked the stuff. I liked what it did. I didn't like the taste of it, but every drink I ever took, and this is the truth, I had to have a reason for taking that drink. Now, I could just reach up into thin air and produce a reason without too much trouble. But here this man told me, depression is the cause of your drinking. And did I use that from there on? Every time I wanted to drink, I just switched on a button and became depressed. And it was just as simple as that. Of course, my depression was happening rather rapidly, as May may tell you. It was almost every day when I was on these binges until I came off of them. But unknowingly, he had said something to me that allowed me to satisfy myself for doing something that I was quite sure was not the thing for me to do. And so, depression, well, I was subject to depression. Who isn't? What alcoholic isn't subject to depression at times? And for many years, I used this thing. And then one time, I came out of one of these drying out emporiums, as they were called then, and they did a fair job. They always welcomed you when you got there. I never knew when they welcomed me when I got there, but they told me they did. And whenever you left, they'd pat you on the back and say, now, good luck to you, but if you get on another one, you know where to come to, you know, that sort of thing. And we didn't have rehabilitation as such in that particular day, but they did a pretty good job. And so I came out from there and went back into the stream of life again, went back to work. Now, I have a very wonderful wife, and she put me through some pretty... Now, you Al-Anons, you're wonderful people, but I want to tell you this. Some of you gave us a pretty rough time, too, you know. Now, May did these things, I'm quite sure, with the best of intentions. I think she thought about this thing, and I think she had my welfare at heart. But she didn't know the agony she was causing me. Because when I came home, I was welcomed home. Oh, the food was prepared. I'd sit down, and we were congenial, and we'd talk, and I kept cringing, when's it gonna hit? And I just kept cringing, and the next day it'd be the same day. She had about a 30-day cycle of that sort of thing, with me dreading to get up every morning, not wondering what was going to happen that day. And she was just as nice as could be. About 30 days later at breakfast, she'd let me have both barrels. And I suffered for 30 days waiting for the execution. But it was effective, I guess. You know, this program of ours, which has been so wonderful for all of us, there's no need for me to stand here and praise the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The praise is out there. It's with every one of you in your hearts this morning. And I'm sure that every one of us are grateful to God and for the instrument of God that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is a spiritual program. We all must realize that, I think. Some shy away from that. But do you recognize that the word alcohol is used only one time in the 12 steps, and the word God is used four times in the 12 steps? The word alcoholic is used only one time in the 12 steps. And here, our founders, our beloved and divinely inspired founders, have left this legacy to us. Based upon the most negative statement that a person can make about himself. I am powerless over alcohol. My life has become unmanageable. There's nothing more negative than that to say, I'm whipped, I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable. And through the 12 steps, and we come to that wonderful 12th step, in which is a dedication and a benediction for all of us, in which we dedicate ourselves to trying to carry the message to those who still suffer. Another striking thing to me about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is simply this. It's all in the past tense. It's all been proven. It doesn't say you should do this or that or the other. But they say, this is what we did. This is what we did. And this is the result of what we did. Nothing about you shall do. And at one time in the early days of AA, and all this thing bothered me so much, they said there are no musts in AA. I couldn't quite get that, but the old timers said that, and they had something I wanted, and I tried to take it, but I was frustrated about this thing about no musts in AA. And then they pulled another one on it, this recurring proposition of You can be selective in the 12 steps, and that bothered me a great deal. I figured if the 12 steps were there, that they all were important. But some of them told me, said, you just pick out those that appeal to you. I think that they figured that someday the others would come to you. But that bothered me a great deal, and I had it brought very closely home to me. At one time, I hadn't been in so very long, in AA so very long, until I was talking about that step down there, you know, about making amends to this guy. And he said, what in the hell are you doing down there? You haven't taken step one yet. And I realized what he was talking about. These steps are designed and placed in the sequence that they are, in my judgment, because they belong that way. We begin with the negative statement. We begin with a confession. We begin with a faith. And on that we progress right on down to the 12th step, wherein is our dedication and our benediction. How it was and what happened, they say, how it is now. Well, I told you a little bit about how it was. There's one other thing I'd like to tell you to show you the impact that these things can. I was up in the sand hills of North Carolina here a few years ago, and it was on a hot July Sunday afternoon. And the gnats were flying, and everybody was steaming and hot, and there was a big crowd there, and we were swatting at the mosquitoes and flies, and there was a dedicated doctor there, and he had been to one of these funny farms too, and so he made his talk, and as I sat there and listened to his wonderful story of recovery, I thought to myself, where under heaven could you get 300 people together who would sit and sweat and fight gnats and listen to two escapes from an insane asylum? They tolerate us. They love us, and we love them. And so, how it was? Yes, there was a lot of misery there. There was a hospital. There was this tremendous load of guilt and fear and loneliness. And then what happened? Well, I discovered Alcoholics Anonymous. I hunted Alcoholics Anonymous because up in my county of Berkeley in North Carolina, Monk's Corner is the capital of Berkeley County, North Carolina, it lies between Purgatory Plateau and Hellhole Swamp. So if you're ever up that way, look us up, please. I discovered Alcoholics Anonymous. I had read a little bit of it, and I'd come had just returned from this drying out place, and this thing was getting serious then. I had returned from this drying out place, and I knew time was running out on me, and I don't believe that fear was the motivation there at all. I had the feeling that if something isn't done, there will be no hope. I was still clinging a little bit to the hope that I, Viv Engel, could do something about this thing. It didn't turn out that way. So on a Sunday afternoon, I went to Charleston, and we had a small club room on the street there, and I suppose some of you know something about Charleston, that it was Sunday afternoon, and the bar was next door, full blast. But anyway, there was a door between this little room and the bar. And I thought that was rather peculiar until I found out why. The bartender was not an AA. But if he knew you to be an AA, don't ask him for a drink. You just didn't get it. And he answered the telephone for us in the club room. He was one of the best AAs I ever saw not to be an AA. But we just didn't drink at his bar at all. He just wouldn't tolerate that a bit. And I walked in, and there was a man sitting there by himself. And I began to talk a little bit and ask a little bit. And I saw he was getting a little bit rested. And I was firing questions at him right and left and every which way. Finally, I said, listen here, fella. I ain't been in this thing long either. And I can't answer your questions, but says up here at the old Sibsel building on Marion Square, says that they have a meeting on Thursday night up there, and there's going to be some old-timers there. And so why don't you go up there Thursday night and ask them a few of these questions? Maybe they can help you. I was there on Thursday night, bright and early, got a seat fairly close up because I wanted to be seen. I wanted the limelight, you know, that sort of thing. As a drunk, I was in the limelight frequently, and I still wanted to be in the limelight, I suppose. So I sat up there, and I was ready. I don't know. I told you I was reared in a parsonage. And for some reason, I kind of had the idea that this was a sort of an evangelistic revival meeting sort of thing that I was going into. I guess that was my early training that led me to believe that. And I sat there and waited, not for the altar call particularly, but to be given a chance to say my bit. I was ready to confess. I was ready to admit. You name it, anything from rape to murder to simple offenses, I'd plead guilty to it. That was what I was there for. And I sat there and waited and waited. And they went through the meeting, and they didn't pay a bit of attention to me. And I was hurt. Here I was offering myself to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they didn't say a word to me about it at all. But a strange thing happened there. I couldn't explain it. There was a sort of a warmth that I began to feel that I hadn't felt in many years. There was a sort of atmosphere of friendliness that just permeated the place. And oh, I felt good. I felt good. They hadn't given me my chance to confess, but I found out later that they weren't interested in my confession at all. All they were interested in was, you're here, you're here, and we're glad to have you. And so, time and again, I went to the meetings down there, and time and again, I listened to the old-timers, and time and again, they'd say things that I couldn't understand, and they'd say things that would make me cringe, because they'd say things like, you got to look to God, but God can be the kitchen sink. I couldn't quite take that kitchen sink business for God. But I know what they meant, something to tie to, something that you could take hold of. And then one wonderful night as I sat on the back seat, sweating and stewing and waiting for things to happen, there was an old seafaring man that sat by me. He had wandered the world, all of the seven seas. I didn't know him, and he sat there. He was not what you would call a cultured, educated man. He was just a simple, wise man. And he saw me squirming and sitting there, and finally he leaned over to me and he said, listen, bud, and that connected us because I was older than he was. He said, listen, bud, why in the world don't you reach for the God of your understanding? Leave off this borrowed God, your God, the God of your understanding. And you know, things began to open up. The windows opened and the sunlight streamed in. The God of my understanding, not the God that I'd been told about way off yonder in the sky somewhere, remote, cold. This heavenly policeman was just ready for me to raise my head to be knocked down again if I committed error. No, he said, the God of your understanding. And then it was that I began to learn a little bit about what AA meant. The God of my understanding understood me. He understood my frailties. He understood my selfishness. He understood my fears and my loneliness. He understood my self-pity. He understood my desires. And he understood my fight against him. Because he dragged me into his care, screaming and fighting and refusing to admit that this was something I couldn't do under my own. Yes, it was there, the God of my understanding, that the impact of AA began to take hold. And so, how it is now? Well, it's fine, just fine. And I can't say any more than that about how it is now, except perhaps to point out that there's a delight in living now. And I liked the way Priscilla put it yesterday morning, not a way of life, but a way of living. Active, a way of living. Something thrilling, something wonderful. The thrill of freedom and the joys of solitude, being alone and not being lonely. Solitude, you know, is creative. Solitude is something that builds us up. Loneliness is a fearful and frightening thing that can destroy us. But solitude, where we can commune with the God of our understanding, and where we can look within our own hearts and see there not only the yearning but the hope, and see there not only the hope, but there is a realization of that hope, and it becomes very real and very true. Sometimes I know we're all emotional. All of us are. We're emotional beings, and sometimes in the mountains to watch a red sunset go down, I can almost weep. And to hear the laughter of a little child causes a sob in my throat. Emotional, yes, thank God we're emotional. You know, I was speaking in a meeting one time many years ago, and there was a judge in that meeting. And he was a great man, a good man. I didn't know him at the time. And after the meeting, he came down, as they do. You know, these people are awfully nice to us, whether they mean it or not, and I always want to believe they mean it. He wanted to talk to me a little bit, says, I appreciate what you said tonight. It had some meaning for me. He says, you know, I wish I were an alcoholic. And I thought, my God, I missed the mark here. I'm creating alcoholics out here. Here's a judge, an intellectual man who wants to be an alcoholic. I thought he was going to ask the directions as how to become one. And I was ready to give it to him, too. But he said, he saw I was rather astounded by this thing, and he said, here's what I mean. He said, you're in my town, the town that I was born in. And says, I grew up here. Says, I was not a sissy, but I was a reasonable good boy. I was not a juvenile delinquent. I did the usual things boys do. I never did get in any trouble with the law or anything growing up. I went through high school and enjoyed my high school days. Never any trouble. A lot of fun, a lot of joy. And then I went away to school and I was elected president of my law class and just enjoyed. Life has been wonderful, wonderful for me. But he says, you've got something here that I have not. I said, please tell me. He said, my life has been like this, a level line. If we charted it, it would be just a line across the paper there. And says, you people, because you have been down in the mire of life, you can ascend the heights that I can only dream about. And I wish I could be there with you. I knew what he meant. I knew that those of us who've been down in the swamplands of life, that whenever we are given the opportunity and whenever the God of us all reaches down and picks us up and takes us up to the heights, then it is that we have such feelings that we can weep or we can laugh, but we can't describe them, you know. We can't describe them. They're too deep. They're too wonderful for such description. And so I knew what this great judge meant. And really, I felt sorry for him because he couldn't get what we had. I hope someday that I hope he doesn't get drunk to do it, but I hope someday he may be. Now, I'm not attempting to evangelize here with you this morning on this final meeting of this wonderful convention. I may and myself are just visiting with you a little while, and we're so grateful for this privilege of being with you. And I'm not seeking to change any person's applications of the 12 steps to his own life as long as he's getting satisfaction and happiness in this sobriety that he has found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so for that reason, anything I say here this morning is a personal opinion. It's an opinion that comes out, I would like for you to believe, that comes out of my heart. And so I just want to talk to you like it is to me, like it is now. And so for myself, as I say, I encountered some musts in AA in the early days, despite what they told me. By must, I do not believe that those who have said those things meant that there was a compelling force put upon us, that we were compelled to do something. No, no, it wasn't that. The must that I'm talking about, or the must that the big book tells me about, and I say it's only for myself, because the big book says to it, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, that is a must. That's a must for Viv Engel, to go to any length to get it. And I wanted what AA had to offer. I still want what AA has to offer today. I want, and in getting what AA has to offer me, I must decide. This thing can't happen to me automatically. I must decide. And I must choose. The gift of choice that the God of us all has given us, the greatest gift I think that can come to mankind, is the gift of choice. I must accept the fact that I am an alcoholic. That's step one again. That I am an alcoholic. And I must recognize that I need help, that I cannot do this thing alone. The help that you can give me as an instrument of the God of your understanding. And I must accept the help that is available to me. There are no options here. These are musts for me, and I believe they are musts for most of us, even though we may not be conscious of them. And in admitting, I prefer the word accept, and I think most of us do, because to admit a thing, I could admit most anything, and I used to do it in my drinking days. I'd admit anything to get out of the jam. But admit means something different. Accept. Whenever I accept a thing, it becomes a part of my very personality, a part of my very being. It becomes a part of me to accept this thing. And if I accept an attitude and a belief, then those things are basic in my search for permanent sobriety. And that's what we're talking about here, sustained, permanent sobriety. Not the kind that I had in the early days. I wasn't among that high percentage that made it from the very beginning, you know. I went in and I went to work in AA. I thought it'd be best to limit my activities to the little town of Monk's Corner. I wanted to get them all in right there. I felt like, now we'll start at Monk's Corner and I'll get all the drunks in here and that'll be a good start. Then I'll expand out into Berkeley County. And Berkeley County includes Hellhole Swamp, and that was a big deal there. And I was going to do this, and then after I got Berkeley County all fixed up, then I began to branch out over the state and see what we could do with South Carolina. I had it. I had it, and I was going for it. And so that continued for about 3 months, just short of 3 months. And one day, I guess it was this depressive mood that the psychiatrist made the mistake of telling me about. One day I got to thinking, what about this thing? Here, all this business about alcoholism being an illness, all this business about a compulsion to drink, I haven't had a drink in nearly 3 months. And I feel a little bad, and maybe a drink will help me. Maybe a drink will help me, so I got what you always got when you went to the liquor store, a half pint. Not a fifth, a half pint. So I got the half pint and I went home and I drank it before supper. And I think May and the boys must have suspected something because I was cheerful at supper that night. But they didn't say a word. They didn't say a word. Oh, I have a wonderful family. They kind of carrying me along. They didn't say a word, and so I thought, well, this is it. I got up next morning just feeling fine. The world's a wonderful place in which to live, striding down the street with my head high. Along about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I got thinking about this thing again. Well, I thought, well, it worked yesterday. I guess it worked today. It may take a little more today, but I think it'll work. So I did. Oh, you are way ahead of me. I'll tell you, I can see that. There's no need to go into all that thing. Well, it happened. About 3 days later, I was dragged into one of these drying out emporiums again. And when I say dragged in, I speak advisedly. They never got me there under my own power. I was carried in. They could take a fifth and just lead me all over the Southeast. And that's what they did. And I always ended up in one of these places. And so I ended up in the drying out place again. But you know something? That was a short binge. But it was one of the most agonizing binges that I ever experienced. It was one of those things that made me think about, well, you know, there were a few people who began to believe in me again. And I don't think I was conceited or cocky about this thing at that particular time. And I had begun to believe a little bit in myself. And I had begun to have a vision of a God of my understanding. And here I had let everybody, everything, myself, God, I'd let them all down and ended up in this drying out place again. But do you know one thing? That's one of the greatest blessings that ever came to Bill Engle. It cut him down to size. I quit running around and hunting drunks. You didn't have to hunt very far in my town, but I quit running around hunting them up. I tried to make myself available to them, and that was a rather difficult task because I was the first to... I was introduced this way one time, I'll put it that way, up at Greenwood on a family afternoon on the shores of Lake Greenwood there, sloping up, the kids playing all over, the family sitting there, and they allowed me to speak. And this fellow got up and said, "We got with us this afternoon Bill Engle from Monk's Corner." And you know, Monk's Corner's in Berkeley County, and his only claim to fame is that he's the first admitted living alcoholic in the history of Berkeley County. And he went on to say there are a lot of dead ones down there. And there's some drunks down there. But he's the first guy that ever admitted that he was an alcoholic in the history of Berkeley. And come to think of it, I think that was true. I was a freak around that town. Here was a guy who couldn't drink. You know, I think this wasn't true, but I was told one time that mothers in raising their children out on the fringe of hellhole, now you better be good boys and good girls or you may grow up to be like Viv Engle that you can't drink. I don't believe that. I really don't, but that's what happened. And we have been told in our literature, the massive literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we emphasize the spiritual because we must have it. And that's what happened to me. I must have it. The spiritual. Religious? No, I guess not. I'm a member of my church, and I go to church, but and we have been told in our literature, the massive literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we emphasize the spiritual because we must have it. And that's what happened to me. I must have it. The spiritual. Religious? No, I guess not. I'm a member of my church, and I go to church. But religion and spirituality are two different things to me. Religion is the collective worship of God, and that is good. Spirituality is whenever I sit alone and establish a relationship, a personal, individual relationship with the God of my understanding, and I can listen and I can hear, and I know He hears. And that to me is the spiritual. And Alcoholics Anonymous in my book is all spiritual. We mention God in the, as I said, in the step, and we don't pay too much attention to alcohol there because we feel that if we mention God, that we are mentioning the way to recovery from this thing that would destroy us. They say these experts in the field, these authorities in the field, that there is no known
single specific cause for alcoholism? And there are a few of us experts, a few of us who are not experts in the field that somehow have that naive feeling that maybe it's because we drank too much, too often, and too long. I remember Lester Henderson. I'm dating myself here, Brother Joe. I remember Lester Henderson in the early days whenever he told his story there about the freak that he was considered to be in his day. And he said that at the Yale School under the beloved Dr. Silkworth, that he was up there the first one that they had admitted for observation up there. Or they'd been fooling with mice and rabbits and things like that for a while. But a drunken rabbit don't give you much trouble. And Lefty was a successful attorney in his state, and he drank himself down the skid row. And Lefty said that they had a meeting about him, a staff meeting, and Dr. Silkworth said, "Well, Lefty, would you like to be present?" And Lefty said that he was a little curious about the thing, and he said, "Yes, sir, I would like to be." And he went to the meeting, and they discussed, they had the zoologists there and the biologists there and all kind of ologists there, and they were beating it around pro and con about the alcoholism and the alcoholic, and finally Lester said he was very humble and said he just said, "Could I say just a word?" And Dr. Silkworth said, "Yes." He said, "Go ahead, Lester." And he said, "Maybe it's because I drank too much liquor." And you know, they created a whole new category in alcoholism around that, the pampered alcoholic. They really did. Really did on that. And so the big book, as I say, which I'm finding more useful, shall I say, more inspirational with each reading of it, you know, it has a way of being kind of frank with us. It tells us what we are. And it tells us what to do. And it tells us what we can expect if we do these things. What we are, let me tell you about the big book here. You know it as well as I do. Let's listen to it for a moment. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were gaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced that alcoholics are in the grip of a progressive illness. The mirror, there we are, look at it. That certainly was a true and realistic picture of me at that particular time. And so, then our next step. Well, what shall we do about this thing? The big book tells us in no uncertain terms. Abandon yourself to God as you understand him. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of your happy destiny. What shall we do? There it is. There it is, if you're honest, if you're sincere, if you want this thing. All right, what shall we expect then if we do these things? And again, the big book. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic is capable of facing his problems in the light of our experience, can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance and belligerent denial. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. And these are the musts of AA of which I have spoken this morning. And the record of AA, the wonderful, wonderful record of AA, reveals that this is a personal, a practical, a proven philosophy. Remember the 12 steps in the past tense? This is what we did, a proven philosophy, a proven program. A person-to-person relationship, a radiant way of life, and this leads to worship. Well, you know we can't stay in AA without worshiping. We'll come to it. I came to it. It took a while, but we come to it. And worship leads to God, the God of our understanding. And God leads us to personal fulfillment. And from fulfillment comes freedom. Freedom, freedom. And if John is here, I want to say to him something here this morning. From fulfillment comes freedom. Freedom to become the person we can be. Freedom from isolation. Freedom to live, to love, and to laugh again. To live without alcohol. Freedom to serve the God of our understanding and our fellow man as a friend. Unbound from the guilt of yesterday. Released from the dread of tomorrow. This is freedom in its finest sense. To doubt if we must. To fight if it's necessary. To reason always. For out of doubt is born faith. And out of the struggle comes peace. And out of agony comes love. And out of experience comes service and the capacity to serve. Alcoholics Anonymous would deny that it is a religion in any sense of the word. Yet its strength comes from the source of strength for all the great religions of the world. This surrender, or the acceptance, as I prefer to say, of which we speak is a surrender to a higher power, to the God of our understanding, a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand it. This I submit as total confession. And then there is acceptance and belonging. On the outside, we may have been hounded and stigmatized because we were drunks or alcoholics. In AA, it's a mark of eligibility. We don't admit anybody who isn't a drunk or an alcoholic. And then there is, using the language of religion, a rebirth. AA calls it a spiritual awakening. And there is love. AA calls it fellowship. But when one or two AAs get out at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to minister to a suffering alcoholic, and that is, I submit to you, love within the sublime meaning of the words of the Master of Life himself. Love one another. And why? Because it's the best medicine for the giver as well as for the receiver. And do you know, we speak of hatred and bitterness and resentment. I read somewhere where a very wise man said simply this. What is the opposite of love? Not hate, indifference. Indifference. And he told the story of the Good Samaritan. The priest passed by. The Levite passed by. And the Good Samaritan stopped. There was no indication that the priest hated the man in the ditch. There was no indication that the Levite hated the man in the ditch. They were indifferent, and God forbid that any alcoholic, any AA, anywhere, anytime, shall be indifferent to the call of a suffering alcoholic, whoever he may be. And do you know that the greatest accolade that can come to you and to me, those of us who have suffered and who have known, is to get a call from somebody who remembers you, remembers what has happened to you, and he calls you in the middle of the night. Oh, I know it can be provoking. Yes, it can be. But out of the whole world, he thinks of you, and he wants what you have. I can think of no greater honor, no greater opportunity, no greater privilege than that somebody thinks that you and I can help them. Some despairing and hopeless, perhaps, guy out there who is suffering. Our founder, Bill, you know, left this with us. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. The hand of AA, that's you. That's me. That's the only hand they have. And the big book again urges me to abandon myself, not analyze the 12 steps. That's fatal for me to attempt to analyze them. Abandon myself to them. Accept them for their face value, whether I understand them or not. Now, some of us would call that faith, and we do need faith. And so, such abandon, I think, establishes true values that tell us that we are indeed helpless in the grip of this thing that is destroying us. And it's only by the grace of God are we healed. It seems to me that the resentments, the hatreds, and the bitterness, and the self-pity, and all these attitudes, it seems to me that the grace of God means a release from these things that I thought made it mandatory that I should drink and drink again, even in the face of destruction. There are things that cannot be purchased, you know, that cannot be fabricated, but which come to us whenever we are alone, in quiet moments, in quiet places, when perhaps a merciful God reveals to us that somehow, knowing the good we have done it, knowing love we have shared it, knowing truth we have spoken it boldly and unafraid. Our preamble tells us that our primary purpose is to stay sober. But there's something there of equal importance. How shall we use this gift of heaven itself, our sobriety? To accept and to be willing to be accepted. To love and to be loved. To give freely without thought of reward. To receive without thought of gain. For at last we find, at long last we find, the strength of surrender, the grandeur of hope, the splendor of love, and the wonder of God. This to me is the finest and best of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the majesty and the glory of your fellowship and of mine, Alcoholics Anonymous. So shall we say, with the poet, waste no tears upon the blotted record of lost years, but turn the leaf and smile, oh smile, to see the fair white pages that remain for thee. Thank you, and God bless you.